Welcome back to the Business of Government Hour. I'm Michael Keegan, your host, and our guest today is Larry Sampler, Assistant to the Administrator and Director of the Office of Afghanistan and Pakistan Affairs within USAID. So, Larry, before we delve into the discussion around transition, this delicate transition period you're going to be experiencing, I would like to talk about some of the actual results and changes in the areas of health, education, and energy within Afghanistan.
The greatest indicator of USAID's successes in Afghanistan, and they're not just USAID's successes, but our contribution to successes in Afghanistan, are probably in the areas of health, education, and opportunities for women and girls in Afghanistan. With respect to health, you know, the bar was originally set incredibly low. Afghanistan, when I got there in 2002 and 2003, was just decimated. There was no health care to speak of. The United Nations, UNDP, the United Nations Development Program, has something called the Human Development Index. And they noted last year that over the course of 12 years in Afghanistan, that country had increased more as a percentage than any other country in the world over the decade. And one could expect that, given the huge amounts of money that the donor community has flooded in. But that includes things like life expectancy has increased by 20 years, from 42 years to 62 years. Mortality rates for children under 5 is reduced by 62%. Maternal mortality has increased by over 75%. And that's largely because USAID pushed a set of trainings for midwives to make sure that births were attended. With respect to education, in 2002, there were less than 500,000 students in school, and the schools were not necessarily of any particular standard. And all of those students were boys. Now that number is approaching 9 million, and more than 30% of the students are girls. And that's important because now at 12 years on, we've been running schools for, depending on when we started the school, up to 12 years, there is a generation of young Afghan men and women who have completed primary education and secondary education, and we now have students entering trade schools or university studies, and many of these are young women. There are women candidates as vice presidential candidates on the tickets. There are women delegates in these provincial council elections, and 35% of the people, or more than 35% of the people who turned out to vote were women. And again, that would have been unheard of in the past. I'll add one more accomplishment that I think underpins all of these, and that is the technological, and revolution is probably not too strong a word to say that cell phone technology is brought to Afghanistan.
Yeah, that's what I wanted to get into, is the mobile technology. I mean, you think of 2002 when you were there, there was some fixed telephone lines, but mainly most calls were done by satellite phone. And yeah. And that's what I'd like to get back to, the sort of the bread and butter kind of infrastructure conversation around mobile telephone and the telecommunications sector. How has that changed? What progress has happened there? And is that tied to any type of energy issues there?
Yeah, so in 2002, we had what we call the UN brick. Ericsson had dropped a repeater off on one of the mountaintops around Kabul. And if you were part of the UN or if you needed one, they would give you a phone that would work only off these repeaters because there were no cell phones. The landlines were controlled by operators. And in many cases, when the Taliban fell, the operators walked away. So getting a landline for an inside-the-country call or to call out was almost unheard of. So, you know, the Ericsson and other satellite phones were common in the early days, as well as, like I said, these UN bricks. And then the Afghans began to develop a market for cell phones, and it developed incredibly quickly to the point that now over 90% of the population of Afghanistan has cell phone coverage, which is on a par with most countries in the Western world, in fact. You know, it does require electricity, but the Afghans have been very entrepreneurial on things like this. They have found ways, even in villages that are off the grid, where the DABs, the Afghan public utility, hasn't yet run transmission lines. They have bought, off the internet in some cases, solar panels, and a young Afghan will set up a phone charging station somewhere in the village, and people will come and drop their phone off, and it'll charge, and they'll pay him a few hundred or a few thousand Afghani for the electricity to charge their phones. One of the ways that that's revolutionized political engagement is that in 2003, when we were trying, the international community wanted to educate all Afghans, rural and urban, about the coming emergency law jirga and then the constitutional law jirgas. We wanted Afghans to understand what was going on. It was not a literate society. They didn't have widespread radio. They had virtually no television. So what we wound up doing was producing CDs. We don't have to do that anymore. Mm-hmm. One of the lessons I'll take away from my now 12 years in Afghanistan is that in societies that are that primitive, and I don't mean that pejoratively, but that are that have so little infrastructure going in, technological leaps like cell phone technology are incredibly influential. Hey,
you see it in Africa, too. I mean, when you see the jump, they didn't waste their time building all these huge infrastructure. They went straight to the cell. I'd like to juxtapose two types of questions. And where I'm going with this is, if you could highlight briefly some of the innovative development solutions you've piloted in either Afghanistan or Pakistan, and then marry that up against the current fiscal austerity you're dealing with. How have you been able to do these innovations while also dealing with the realities of sequestration and fiscal austerity?
Again, staying on the theme of telecommunications. So, for example, with respect to cell phone technology, we would like every family in Afghanistan to have access to a cell phone because it connects them with the greater population and it connects them with the greater world. So to the degree that we can incentivize cell phone ownership, we want to do that. At the same time, Afghanistan is largely an agrarian population. Most of these people are farmers. And so one of our partners developed a data sharing resource that uses SMS technology to send out morning updates on the price of particular goods at particular markets. The regional trade's incredibly low. And it's a goal of ours collectively, state and USAID, to work on increasing the regional economic integration. And to do that, you have to reduce both the real barriers to trade at the customs houses and the border crossings, but also perceived barriers, things that aren't necessarily codified or legal barriers but wind up being barriers anyway. You know, a real simple example of that is between Afghanistan and Pakistan, every border crossing is in the past has been utter chaos. Much more impactful, I think, is making sure that the countries are aware of what's crossing their borders and that they're collecting the proper duties and customs for those goods. We're working on automating some of the customs and duties collection mechanisms. If you're sitting in a truck at the Torkham Gate crossing between Afghanistan and Pakistan, and you have a succession of 8 or 12 men walk up with a receipt book and say, "You owe me $200 for the customs on your truck," you don't know who to pay. You don't know which ones are truly customs collectors, which ones represent the local chief of police, and who's just an enterprising young Afghan or Pakistani man who brought a receipt book and is trying to collect some money. If, on the other hand, you educate the truckers all along that route, and these are usually repeat business, that you can use your cell phone or you can use a particular electronic card, and you know your customs are determined by an inspection of your cargo. What's in the truck is confirmed. We don't want you saying you're inspecting or you're bringing in potatoes when you're bringing in televisions because the duties on those are very different. So we verify what's being transported, and then you electronically submit one time your customs and duties to whichever government is appropriate. You get a receipt for it, and you're on your way. That's a way both to reduce corruption, which is hugely important in Afghanistan and Pakistan, increase government revenues because those electronically transmitted revenues are not susceptible to pilfering and skimming at multiple steps along the way, and it reduces the time requirement tremendously. One of the measures of success for regional economic integration is going to be how long does it take to get a shipment of cooking oil from Almaty in the north through Kabul and to Karachi in the south. Those shipping times and the dollars associated with the cost associated with shipment will be how we measure our success in this particular way.
Mm-hmm. So there's a lot of stuff that you were talking about. How does the innovation that you've outlined, how has it been pushed or prodded or impacted by the budget austerity that you had to deal with, that the government has had to deal with?
In terms of austerity, we now look for programs where we get multiple benefits from each program. It's no longer enough to have an agriculture program. Our ag programs have got gender components. They involve technology. They involve innovation. We achieve this by when we put out a request for proposals, we incentivize the partners, who are some of our best and most innovative thinkers, we tell them, we will consider your proposal positively if you have found ways to synergistically work with these other programs that are already in the area. The partners are the ones who have the time, and they've got the intellectual energy to sit around and come up with really creative ways based on their experiences in Afghanistan and around the world to help us get more bang for the buck. In the early days in Afghanistan, we were all about saving lives. There were literally thousands and thousands of Afghans dying from tainted water or lack of medical care. So in the early days, it was get the programs out there and get them out there fast. We've done that now. And as I talked about earlier, we've seen the accomplishments of immediate USAID engagement. Now we're a bit more sophisticated. We want to build the Afghans' capacity to pick this up and sustain it and run with it. And we want to see more value from each program through a variety of different sectors.
So, Larry, you have a unique perspective working on both the military and civilian sides of the U.S. government. What do you see as some of the main leadership differences between the military and aid? And how is what are you doing different in conflict zones?
Yeah, when I first came out of the military working in civilian government, I used to describe the difference this way. I would say in the military, you have a command and control environment where a commander will task her staff or his staff to come up with courses of action, and the staff will go away and it'll be messy and bloody and there'll be fights and arguments, but they'll come up with three courses of action. And the commander will have an intellectual debate about each of the courses of action, and then she or he will take a decision. It's a very clear process, and there's never any question about who's making the decision. On the civilian side, as opposed to command and control, I used to describe it as what struck me as beseech and cajole, because in civilian organizations, there wasn't this crisp, clear, command-oriented, command-driven decision-making process. Now, I've come to value that a lot more, and I understand why in the areas of diplomacy and in the areas of development, a more collaborative approach to decision-making is important. But I think for professionals coming into the field from one side to the other, they need to understand the differences. That it means that in the military, decisions can typically be made in a much quicker cycle of time. There's a tremendous book by Jim Locker called Victory on the Potomac, which talks specifically about how the militaries, and there were multiple militaries, Army, Navy, Air Force, and Marines, were brought to jointness. And everyone had recognized that it needed to be done, but bureaucratically in Washington, it just wasn't possible until it was driven by the Goldwater-Nichols Act. And Jim Locker was one of the authors as a young congressional staffer working on that. And the book articulates very well the challenges to creating interagency collaboration in a bureaucratic place like Washington, D.C., and then the remedies that were required to get to jointness, which included things like you can't get promoted to your next higher level until you've had a joint assignment. You force Marines to go work in a joint assignment, and you force Army and Navy officers to go work in a joint assignment. And it was painful for the first 4, 5, 7 years, but now joint assignments are highly sought after because they're seen by military officers as giving them a broader perspective, and not just a prerequisite to promotion, but it also equips them for working at higher levels. We don't have that on the civilian side. So when you marry state and USAID, or when you marry USAID and the Department of Agriculture or Commerce, we haven't had that cross-pollination that joint assignments will produce, and so the clash of cultures can be quite strong. You know, I don't know that we'll ever get to a Goldwater-Nichols for the civilian parts of the United States government, but I do think, I hope, that 10 years from now when I leave federal government, I'll be able to look back and see that we have managed to adapt decision-making, whether civilian, military, or whatever agency or bureau, we can adapt our decision-making to the situation on the ground.
What is USAID's threefold transition strategy? I will ask Larry Sampler, Director of the Office of Afghanistan and Pakistan Affairs within USAID, when our conversation continues on the Business of Government Hour.